Good evening and welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is the very talented singer-songwriter from Williamstown, Massachusetts, Bernice Lewis. Lewis studied vocal improvisation with Bobby McFerrin and songwriting with Roseanne Cash and Chris Williamson. She's a fixture on the coffeehouse circuit, on contemporary folk radio, and at major folk festivals. Lewis recently released her sixth CD called She Undoes. I'm speaking to Bernice Lewis from WCFM Radio at Williams College in Williamstown, Massachusetts. Bernice Lewis, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, you're more than welcome. I'm thrilled to be here.
Listen, I want to talk to you a bit about your beginnings. Like so many musicians and songwriters I've spoken to, did you discover music at a young age as well?
Yeah, I think, you know, like many, many, many other musicians, it was a saving grace for me. My parents got divorced when I was young, and I was alone. Well, I had siblings, but I spent a lot of time, you know, on my own, and I sang a lot. I memorized all the songs from musicals, you know, West Side Story and Sound of Music, of course, and those things. And it was really important. And then the Beatles came along, and I started playing guitar. And I think it was really, and there wasn't anyone else in my family who was musical. Unlike many musicians, I was kind of a first-generation musician.
Now, I also know that you're a published poet. So were you writing poetry before you segued into songwriting?
Yeah. Uh-huh. I was. Well, I don't know that I'm a very good musician. I tend to come at things. I mean, I've studied music really hard, and I work at it and practice every day. But I always come at things from a lyrical or a plot, a storyline place. And I wrote poetry when I was really young. I have a little pile of papers from when I was in grade school of like some of the really bad poems I wrote, my first crushes and things like that. And people, I remember once in the cafeteria in like sixth grade or seventh grade, I don't remember how old I was, somebody passed me one of those like sophomoric love poems and said, "Have you seen this?" And it was actually something I'd written without my name on the bottom. And I was like, "Yeah, I've seen it." So it came very much first, and I majored in English in college and wrote poetry as a main focus of my major, and only started writing songs after I got out of undergraduate school, and just between that and grad school, I just started writing songs one day. It was just this kind of little tiny leap from one to the other.
Mm-hmm. And can you tell the difference when a poem is coming out or when it's going to be a lyric?
Yeah, usually. Sometimes I use the poems as like a sketch pad, like a watercolor, mm-hmm. and a song is more like an oil. But they can trick me. Like the title cut to my last album, which is called She Undoes, actually started as a poem. But it's extremely rare. More or less, it's either one or the other, and they feel differently. For me, writing poems is actually less work.
Really?
Yeah. Well, because it's one dimension. Songwriting is two dimensions, so you have to have the music and the lyrics, and they have to there has to be that prosody thing where, you know, the tempo and it has to fit the mood of the story or whatever. Whereas with a poem, and nowadays especially with poems, you don't even need to rhyme.
Right, and hopefully one doesn't a lot of the time either.
Exactly, it's not fashionable to rhyme. Songwriting is a real slave master. I mean, you have to rhyme and scan just like the old, you know, old poems from, you know, different centuries. It's almost a new fangled way of keeping the discipline alive, you
mm-hmm,
know.
Mm-hmm. And you have to capture the feeling of the song with music and not let it betray what you're trying to say too, right?
Mm-hmm.
Would you say?
And then for me, because I've taught songwriting for a long time, and so many of my friends are songwriters. I mean, for me, if you can't get what I'm trying to say, if the music covers up my words, then I don't feel like I've accomplished what I'm trying to do. Other songwriters, and I often envy them, you know, will write a really amazing melodic sequence or chord sequence, and that carries the song, you know, and that's a whole other way of writing songs, and it can work. And if you look at songwriting, you'll sometimes hear yourself singing a lyric that doesn't make that much sense, but there's something very compelling about the melody, so it's
mm-hmm.
stuck in your brain.
Mm-hmm. Now, I understand you studied songwriting, actually, with Roseanne Cash and Chris Williamson. What kinds of things did you learn from those experiences?
Well, I've studied songwriting a lot with a lot of different people. Those are probably the two better known ones. But I've studied with, there was a guy named John Imes who wrote some big country hits that I, that mentored me for a while. And also someone from Berkeley, Jimmy Kachulis. I've learned a lot of things about songwriting over the years. I don't know what I specifically learned from either Chris or Roseanne, although they're both really nice people.
Oh, yeah, and they're really good songwriters. I know Chris Williamson's stuff a little better, but I think they're fabulous.
I was not a big Roseanne Cash fan when I took the workshops with her, but I have to say that her, not her last album, I haven't heard the one about her dad yet, but the one before that called Rules for Travel, I was blown away by the songwriting on that album. I thought it was fabulous.
Mm-hmm.
She comes at it very much from a poet's place.
I can sense that.
Yeah.
Yeah, her lyrics are absolutely wonderful.
Yep. And then Chris, I think, comes at it more from a politician's place, you know, although, and she writes beautiful love songs.
Oh, yeah. I would call her a poet politician.
Yeah. They were both wonderful to study with.
Oh, yeah, I'll bet. Now, do you remember when you first knew that you were ready to take both your music and your songs into the public arena? When did you start performing?
Well, as a kid, I did a lot of it. You know, I think prepubescence, it's easy to sing and play and dance and do all those artsy things in our culture. And then there's this point, you know, just maybe 10, 11, 12 years old, where it becomes very taboo in our entire culture to make any noise or sound or movement with your body. And I got caught up in that web and didn't get back to it until after graduate school when I started writing songs. And what I remember is that I had a teaching job that didn't work out, and I packed up all my stuff, and on a whim, I moved to Arizona. And I got a job and discovered the open mic. I'd never heard of an open mic.
Mm.
And I went to an open mic at a bar, and I saw other people doing that, and I had this... I mean, I was in my late 20s, very late for coming into this business.
Oh, yeah.
And I had this thought, like, this is what I've always wanted to do. I knew it when I was younger, and my parents talked me out of it, and I still know it. And at that point, there was a lot at stake. I mean, I was already on my own. I had a graduate degree in education. I had a job in administration, but it was this real deep kind of knowing thing. I had a relationship that ended because of that, in part because of that decision. That I just, and I was so far from home.
Yeah.
And I just started my life over. I just started going out to play. And honestly, Tish, I don't think I was very good.
Really? Because you certainly are now, I must say.
Thanks. Well, I have this theory that if in the beginning, if you don't, it's a blessing to not know whether if you're not good.
but not to the onlooker or the listener.
Maybe. Well, you know, I don't know if you've ever been to an open mic, but they can be pretty torturous.
Yes, I have, so therefore I don't go anymore.
Right. So I went to a lot of them, and I started to pick up little gigs here and there for tips and $25 and $50. And then on a whim, I didn't like Phoenix very much, and on a whim I got a job at on the south rim of the Grand Canyon. And I took the job and went up there. And there's a lot, at that point in time, this is 20 years ago, there were a lot of motels and clubs and stuff that had entertainment. And so I started getting a lot of gigs up there.
Wow. So you took a fancy to it just out of the blue in your late 20s. That's quite a story.
I don't know if it was a fancy. I think it was like a disease.
An addiction, perhaps.
Well, it is. I don't know about the perhaps. I think playing music is an addiction.
Mm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's a positive addiction. I have a 30-year-old daily yoga practice, and that's also a positive addiction.
Yeah, I was going to talk to you a bit about that toward the end of the show. Now, you know what I want to do? I want to play an excerpt from... I want to play the title song from your newest CD. It's called She Undoes. Let's listen to this.
Great, yeah. She's my sweet epiphany. Maybe I thought the mountains weren't so steep. Maybe I thought the river.
You know, Bernice, you have a gorgeous voice. I'm sure you've heard that before. It's been described as lake clear. It's just amazing. But tell us a little bit about this song, She Undoes.
Thank you, by the way. There's a lot of beautiful voices out there. This is one of the very rare situation where this came out of a poem. I try really hard, having studied with a few people who talk about, you know, like the Nashville way of writing songs, which is you basically wash the poetry out of the song like you would get a stain remover almost. And, you know, and because the general public isn't always into the deep metaphor, and so I try not to indulge myself too much with my love of poetry. But with She Undoes, I think I let it happen because I never imagined that song to be a keeper. I wrote it for myself. I wrote it about my daughter who came into my life 6 years ago and changed it, of course. And it was the frustration of having everything in your life just undone all at once by a toddler, coupled with, of course, feeling that love that people always talk about that you feel when you bring a child into your life. So that was part of it. And then it's part of a collection of songs that I write for myself. I always have a song or two that I've written just for me that I use as practice to warm myself up. And so I played it a lot during my practice sessions, but I had never, ever performed it on stage, ever.
Mm.
And I threw it into a pile of songs just on a fluke that I was sending to my producer in Nashville when I went to make this album. And it made the cut. He liked it. He liked the chords because it has a jazzy feel to it. He's a jazz musician, and he just liked it. And I thought, well, okay, we'll record it. It'll probably just be an album cut. And we recorded it, and as we started to sift through the songs, it kept coming. The recording came out so nice that it just kept coming up higher and higher toward the top of one of the better cuts. And then one day he looked at me and he said, I think you should put this on the album first, because we never know until they're done what's going first, and I also never know until I'm done what I'm going to call the album.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, you know what, I think you're right, and I think it's also going to be the title cut. And we were completely
surprised.
Going into it would have imagined that.
Yeah, it's a beautiful song, and it does have a little bit of a jazzy improv feeling. You know the music.
That's good. I study jazz a lot. And
really?
I admire it, yeah.
Oh, well, it comes out in that. If you're just joining us, my guest is Bernice Lewis. She's a singer-songwriter extraordinaire. Now, do you find it's important to write from your own experience, or do you think it's valid to also extract stuff from things that are going on with your friends and your family?
Well, aren't those your own experiences?
Well, I mean, like if you have a girlfriend who's breaking up with her husband and you write about that, that's not necessarily your immediate experience.
Except that you're sort of experiencing it vicariously if you're intimate friends with... I think it's almost impossible not to write from your own experiences. I think when you try to write something you don't know, it almost always comes out too dry.
Mm.
That being said, as my life stabilizes, which is something I'm grateful for, I find that I have to sort of dig into that bag that you're talking about a little bit too, of other people's experiences. But you still can't write what you don't know. So, you know, if my girlfriend and her husband are breaking up, I have to either be able to dive in from an empathetic place because she's so confided in me, and that's a tricky area.
Oh yes.
Or like I just wrote a new song that I haven't, you know, it's I wrote it after I put this album out, and it's called Just Rain, and it's about a woman who's been abandoned by her husband. And, you know, I asked myself who I was writing about sort of after it was finished, because it's written from a very modern perspective of a woman, you know, in our time. But that's what happened to my mother, you know, well, I don't know, a long time ago now,
mm-hmm.
40 years ago. And I realized that even though the language of the song is about somebody who's, you know, driving an SUV, the personage that I'm writing about is my mother.
Oh, so it came full circle.
Mm-hmm. And also you can take that poetic license thing, you know, where you're changing the details and moving, and you don't have to tell the truth. But you still have to have been close enough, I think, to a story to be able to touch it somehow
mm-hmm.
with your hand, you know. Like, I don't think I could write a good song about Katrina, Hurricane Katrina.
Yeah.
You know?
No firsthand experience, but...
Right.
Yeah.
I could write a folk song, an anthemic
yeah.
kind of thing, but I just don't enjoy writing those.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, it certainly shows in your writing. Now, I also want to talk to you about your voice, again, back to your voice. Your voice sounds like it's naturally beautiful, and I understand that you actually studied vocal improvisation with Bobby McFerrin. Is this a trained voice we're hearing, or is it just something that's been improved upon?
Yeah, I think the latter. Because the more I kind of listen to people's voices, I took a class here at Williams this year on the human voice, and both the anthropology of it and the mechanics of it, and it was fascinating, and I learned a lot, and I learned about what I don't do. Thank you for liking my voice, Tisha. I think it's a usable tool. I hear a lot of great voices out there that I'm envious of.
Really?
Mm-hmm. But I, at the same time, oh yeah, God, there's so many good voices out there. Mm-hmm. In fact, I had a radio show once and I called it the Voices Show.
Oh.
I do work on it though. I do scales. I've done some training. I don't train continuously. I listen closely to other singers and try to imagine if I might flesh something out in my voice. But I wouldn't call it a trained voice. I think it's what I was born with, and just try to make it fly.
And so you've learned just a few tricks by taking improv.
I think I've learned more tricks from yoga than anything else, really.
For your voice as well, huh?
Yeah, I think yoga's a great tool for learning how to breathe, and the voice is built on top of the breath. So, but I would love to study with a great teacher. Again, you know, I think about it. It's not something that's fit into my life. Studying with Bobby McFerrin was great. It was quite a while ago. He is one of the most amazing musicians on the planet.
Yeah.
Did I learn anything about my voice from it? I don't know. I learned a lot about musicianship and improvisation. I've also studied with Rhiannon.
Oh, really?
Yeah, quite a bit. More recently, and she's a wonderful vocal person. I haven't done any solo private studying in a long time, though.
Well, you know, there's still time to go back to that. I heard that Joan Baez went back and restudied voice when she was in her late 50s. So it's never too late to
start. She lost her low end. And Roseanne Cash, after she had her son, she had a son who's now same age as my daughter. He's 6 or 7, Jake. Lost her voice completely.
Really?
Yeah, and it had to, during her pregnancy, and had to go in with a coach. And I personally thought it came back better.
Ooh.
Yeah, it's definitely not too late. It's one of the things on the list.
Now, I want to play another piece from your CD, She Undoes. This piece is called Anasazi Girl.
Oh.
I am an Anasazi girl. I plant the crops in spring. Then I wait with my family to see what time will bring. I wait for an animal or darkness or dawn or the sound of the flute on the wind. I go down to the river in the cool evening air. The wrens and swallows taunt me as I unbraid my hair. They seem to say, hey, grab a wing and I'll take you across to the sound of the flute on the wind. Sometimes the river's bluer than the bluest of our skies, and then she runs as muddy as the color of our eyes. When he's lonely, Cocopelli drinks her waters dry with the sound of the flute on the wind. Hey, yeah.
Now, I'm fascinated by this song, Bernice. It feels very old and traditional, and I understand it was inspired by the Grand Canyon. Talk to us about it.
Well, let me just preface whatever I would say about that song is with this statement that I make sometimes from the stage as a joke, except it's not really a joke, and that is that I was born to the Jewish faith, and technically speaking, I'm Jewish, but I did convert in my late 20s, and my new religion is the Grand Canyon. And so it's a place where I make lots. I go there every year with my husband and my daughter for pilgrimages and hike to the bottom and spend a lot of time. And it's the anecdote for the antidote for the working in the music business, and all of that stuff. That song is pretty old for me, and I only recorded it. I was shocked when Charlie told me he wanted me to put it on the CD. And my daughter, who's 7, that's her favorite song of mine, and she sings it all the way through and performs it with me sometimes. I wrote it on a long meditation. It took me about 2-3 years to write it when I realized that there may have been a time when the Colorado River just dried up historically.
Hmm.
You know that, and I've done 3 full-length river trips down the Colorado, and you can stand, there's this place called the Unkar Delta, which is this, you know, delta in the middle of the river, kind of up on the east end of it, and it's covered with pot shards, and you're allowed to stop and spend time there if you're on a boat trip, and you can pick up the shards, and you can play with them, and you can build little cairns with them, but you can't take any of them with you. And so they're everywhere, and it's this little bitty paradise. It's arable, and there's water and shade, and I thought, well, why would anyone leave here? And that was when I started to kind of imagine being an Anasazi girl. And the conclusion I came to during the long meditation of writing the song, which they all kind of are, was that there may have been points in time before they built the dam. And also, I'm pretty much a historian on the Grand Canyon, where the river just literally dried up or became so muddy that you couldn't use it for anything.
Hmm.
And that's how that...
Yeah, so you were imagining you were a Native American girl during that time, huh?
Yeah, that why they would go away. You know, sometimes the river is bluer than the bluest of our skies, and then she runs as muddy as the color of our eyes. And when he's lonely, Cocopelli drinks her waters dry. With, you know, like that they were just gone. And this was, I wrote this before Cocopelli got so popular.
Really? It's a gorgeous song, Bernice. It really is. I sense so much about nature from it and the past. So I think it's quite effective.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, yeah. Now, you know, a lot of your songs have a feel of nature about them. You're obviously inspired a great deal by nature.
Yeah, aren't you? Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah, but I'm not a songwriter.
My husband runs the outdoor education program here at Williams College.
Mm.
He's passionate about being outdoors. In fact, I don't know what it's like where you are. Are you in Ithaca right now?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's the wind chills right now are well below zero here in New England. And, you know, he's been bugging me that I haven't been spending enough time outside the last couple of days.
He's crazy.
He is. He's crazy. Yeah, he really is. He's done a lot of crazy stuff. And so, yeah, I have a strong relationship with the outdoors. And for 10 years, he and I were caretakers of a wildlife sanctuary.
Oh.
So I spent a lot of time out there on trails. And, you know, before that, I lived inside a national park.
Oh, so you are steeped in this. Yeah, it really reflects in your music.
I think it's the best place to go for metaphors,
don't you? Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's hard to find fresh ones.
Well, you have found a few. Now, before we run out of time, I do want to talk to you about the fact that you teach contemporary songwriting at Williams College. Tell us what you teach. What do you stress
well,
for young songwriters?
Well, I am but a lowly adjunct here, but it's something I really enjoy. For 11 years, I've taught an intensive. It's just a 3.5-week-long intensive on... It's called the Contemporary Singer-Songwriter, but it's on performing and songwriting. And I take a group of 15 students. There's no prerequisite in terms of them having to have had musical experience, although they often do end up having had some. But it's a really popular class. I have trouble figuring out how to select them all. But at any rate, and we just start from, we go soup to nuts. We start from the beginning. We do free writing, and we learn how to use our voices, and then we learn about song structure and critiquing, and, you know, it's a workshop setting, and create a real support network inside the classroom so that their songs improve and that they get the information to improve them in a positive way. And then we stage a show the last week of class that's always standing room only, and they each perform something that they've written that month. And we also go to the recording studio. So there's if you go to my website, there's a way probably to link to the site where my students' songs are. Mm-hmm. I'll get one on there, actually.
Yeah, we'll mention that at the end. So what do you tell people about songwriting? That they should be honest, or they should focus on certain subjects? How do you do that?
I try to get them to write about what they know. I give them an initial assignment where they have to write about where they came from. And they fight me on that. They, you know, they want to write about their love life, or they want to write about some novel they've got in their mind. They don't want to write about something as mundane as where they come from. and yet, they often those are the songs that they end up performing, you know, that they turn out to be their better song. We only write 2 in the month. The second one, I give them carte blanche to do whatever they want. But I always give them writing assignments every day to kind of keep them involved with what they're thinking about and what's happening around them. You know, very generic kind of Natalie Goldberg type stuff. Mm-hmm. But
oh, yeah, yeah. But it sounds like it's an opportunity for them to actually focus on a little bit of self-knowledge.
Yeah, it
will.
Is. And I have to say that in an academic setting, they just eat that up like ice cream because they don't get to do much of it. And teaching the class is so much fun for me.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was just going to say, this isn't a culture that really encourages too much looking at self and introspection, it doesn't seem. It's especially in the last few years.
I guess that's true now, isn't it?
Yeah, it seems to be.
Having
yeah.
grown up a hippie, I don't I forget that. But I bet that is true now.
Oh, I absolutely. From the top down in Washington to all kinds of places in our culture, people seem to be leading these really outward lives and not really thinking about what they're doing. And which brings me to my next question. A lot of performers who haven't traditionally written political songs are doing so now, like Neil Young and so on. Are you compelled to start writing some more political songs? Or
I never feel like I understand it fully enough. You know, I feel like I'd write something that, you know, I get passionate about something, and then I feel like I'd miss some real important fact, you know, because there's so much to know with politics. That being said, I do think I've written political songs. They're not on the particular album you have.
Well, I think Where Did the Country Go is somewhat political.
Yeah, it is, actually. Uh-huh. I definitely wanted to say something there.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't think... I mean, I have a song called Normal's Just a Setting on the Washing Machine that sort of addresses a bunch of stuff, but there's a verse in there about there's a sweet couple who live down our street, cat and a dog and a color TV. One does the housework, one brings home the check. It all sounds real normal, but they're both the same sex, you know. So, you know, that's pretty political. That song's probably 10 years old, though.
Mm-hmm.
I have another one about the Atkins diet. I write topical material. I don't think of it as political, and if something moves me strongly enough, I will try to write it. I just don't always feel like I have the facts and figures.
Well, I don't think you need that many facts, really. I mean, going back to what you were talking about, writing from a gut feeling or how you're experiencing what's happening in the culture is probably enough. You're not writing an essay.
And
right?
I have another one on my last album called Religion and Release, but called When the Guru Was Around, that I wrote about a leader that fell from grace, you know, and I think I do write them write political songs more than even love songs. I just think I come at them from a non-anthemic kind of place. Boy, was that an academic kind of statement or what?
But I think you're right.
Yeah, I'm backpedaling here.
Uh-huh, yeah. Well, you know, we're almost out of time. Can you give some information out about how people can get in touch with you? I really recommend that people get some of Bernice Lewis's CDs. She is terrific. So give some contact information, Bernice.
Well, the best place, of course, is to go to BerniceLewis.com. And I put out a newsletter once a month that gets posted there. I believe my email address is on there, so you can write to me through my website. Or you can also go to MySpace.com and you know, put in Bernice Lewis, and you can write to me through there. And all of my CDs are available at CD Baby. So
that's great. That's
easy
great.
To find me.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate being able to talk to you and share your music with our listeners.
I'm deeply honored. Thank you for having me, and thanks for all the things you do, Tish.
Thank you. Bye-bye, Bernice.
Bye-bye now.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. We are supported in part by Finger Lakes Arts Grants and Services. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.